Hi, I'm Mary Wilson. It's October 20th, 2020, and I'm sitting down having a chat with Reverend Joanna Crawford from Live Oak Unitarian Church in Cedar Park. Joanna, thanks for doing this. I'm so excited to talk to you today.
Thanks for asking.
Yeah, so I just want to start with getting a little information about your congregation. Could you give us a little insight as to what your congregation is like and
Sure.
And sort of things that you focus on as a group?
So Live Oak Unitarian Universalist Church has been in the Cedar Park, Northwest Austin area. They were founded about 27 years ago, so a somewhat newish church. And so with where our congregation is, we are theologically extremely liberal. And our members are often very liberal in other ways as well, politically. But we're geographically right at that edge of Travis County, which is liberal, and Williamson County, which has historically been very conservative. But as people are moving out into it, it's becoming more liberal. And right now we're at this point in time where there is a lot of tension going on. And so we're really aware of that. Our members really try to be active in local things.
Yeah, I am aware of some of the tensions in the community because, of course, my congregation is very near Live Oak, and we have similar interest amongst the people that I was serving and the ones you serve. Could you identify some of the tensions that are going on in the community right now?
So part of it is kind of the cultural, social justice mm-hmm. issues. Mm-hmm. We have members of like the Cedar Park City Council who have come out and said things like they're praying against the witches in the community.
Right.
Things you didn't expect to be dealing with. So I don't even want to say, like, it's not even like liberal conservative. It's like farther out than that. So we have some of those things kind of coming.
Yeah, I will have to say, having served my congregation for 18 years before stepping down in April, I had never seen that kind of language being used in the public square that
right.
is present now.
Yeah, the editor of the little local paper here, Hill Country News, like last year put out an editorial that said city council members are supposed to be boring. City council meetings are supposed to be boring, right? Because both at the Gander City Council and Cedar Park, all of a sudden, like, there was all of this drama, just not what you're expecting from there. So that's one of the things that affects our community and affects us. And then I would say also the diversity, the racial diversity that is happening, that many of us consider to be a great thing, you know, that Cedar Park and this area is becoming more racially diverse. You know, other people that don't see it the same way we do. And so that's another kind of element going on.
Yeah. I have noticed that there have been some incidences of racial tension in the area, and especially in this time of Black Lives Matter. And
right.
how has your church responded to that?
So ours has been, I would say probably the two biggest issues for us right now and that have been our biggest issues for a few years have been Black Lives Matter and then anything LGBTQ. And so, you know, our members are often out at the marches, doing mm-hmm. things like that. They are, like, there was an issue about a year ago in Leander where they were going to have, you know, it's kind of a common thing that's been happening around the country, drag queen story time hour. And it became another big you know, drama, and our members were out there at the library trying to stand up for human dignity and inclusivity. Mm-hmm. We had, for you probably remember this, for several years, we had an kind of an old wooden sign that, and we had a rainbow flag on it. And it really had been ignored for quite a while. And then right about a month or so before the Supreme Court ruling on marriage equality, it started getting stolen just over and over. I mean, we just started buying them in bulk. Every time they would steal it, we'd put up another one. And then a couple of years ago, we got, we got an electronic sign. So now the rainbow flag is on there. They can't take it down. We've got Black Lives Matter on there. And really haven't heard much, you know, I haven't gotten any mean letters or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Yeah. Because
I know that can happen. Right. Okay. So that's great. We got a little bit of sense of your congregation. And so I want to kind of go back and start talking more about you. Tell us a little bit about your life story and the things that have shaped you along the way.
Okay. So I'm somewhat of a unicorn in that I'm both a native Texan and a native Unitarian Universalist, which in this part of the country is pretty unusual. So I grew up, you know, in the faith and often a liberal in a very conservative world. I grew up in the outside of Houston and Montgomery County, very conservative. And ministry is my second career. I was in marketing for a long time, and creating websites right at the start of all of that.
I don't think I knew that about you.
Yeah. And so the marketing does still, it was right for me to leave the career because it just, you know, I was trying to get people to spend it's not like I worked for anything nefarious. I worked for a class ring company, but there was still kind of an emotional manipulation that you do.
Yeah.
That didn't feel right to me.
Yeah.
But I was pretty much like still doing freelance kind of graphic design and stuff like that. And raising kids. I'm a mom of four. It was in 2004, and I had actually become a webmaster for our denomination's district and had gone to our annual general assembly. And got one of those, you know, road to Damascus, burning bush, do not pass go calls, which I think is kind of what it took. I think for about 10 years, I'd been kind of hearing the whisper and
doing it.
But I got the anvil dropped on my head, and 2 months later, I was in seminary. I was living in Houston at the time and pregnant with my fourth child. Mm-hmm. And so I went.
The perfect time to make a change of careers.
Right, exactly. and so the seminary choices were somewhat limited there, but there was and is a seminary, an accredited seminary called Houston Graduate School of Theology, and the majority of it's evangelical, but not a particular, but interdenominational.
Right.
And the majority of my classmates were Black. And I thought that was an advantage. And also, I was raised Unitarian Universalist, but in my denomination, the majority of the people who come to a UU church still were not raised in the faith. And so I felt that I needed some grounding in Christianity. So started that, had the baby, you know, took what was supposed to be a short break, and then right as I was about to go back to seminary, she was 6 months old and she was diagnosed with cancer. So that it's not just that that put seminary on hold. It was, I lost my, there needs to be a word beyond atheism. I lost my faith.
Yeah.
I mean, how could there be a call? How could there be, you know, if a baby could, I didn't even know babies could get cancer.
Right, right. I can't even imagine.
I didn't believe in any meaning or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
She recovered. It took me longer to recover.
Yeah.
At a certain point, though, I got the really clear message of, okay, it's time to get back on the path. Went back to seminary, and then right before she turned three, the cancer came back.
Nah.
So I managed, it was towards the end of that semester. So I was able to finish that semester, did what we needed to do. It, you know, if cancer comes the second time, it's a lot harder.
And yeah,
this
yeah.
was.
Yeah.
But I did not have to go through the dark night of the soul that I had gone through before. I had found theological answers that worked even in the presence of a child with cancer.
Yeah.
Eventually she got better and I went back to seminary and now I'm a minister and she's a 15-year-old band geek, you know, completely normal.
That's great. Yeah. That's great. Well, there is no way that hasn't shaped your perspective as a minister then.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
Can you identify or articulate ways that happens?
So I would say, first of all, on kind of the pastoral side of things, knowing that what you think is the worst thing that can happen, that you can survive that, and to be fair, it wasn't the worst, right? She survived. But I have friends who were not so lucky with their time.
Yes. Yes.
But I think that there's something about knowing that you can go through something so terrible and survive it. You know, because sometimes I'm with a member who has just found out something terrible. Mm-hmm. And if it is their first time to really struggle with something like that, to be able to tell them you will make it through this is huge. Because I remember that was probably the most powerful thing that was said to me was I had a friend who coincidentally, her child, she had had a child that had had cancer and had not survived. Mm-hmm. And at a particularly low point, she just, if you believe in coincidences, she just happened to wind up on my front porch and she sat with me while I cried and she said, "You will make it through this." Mm-hmm. And it wasn't meant to be comforting. Like she knew that I probably wouldn't, if the worst happened, I wouldn't want to make it through that. But there was still something so solid in knowing that, okay, because I think you don't, when you're on this side of, on the other side of the equation where you haven't made it through, you just can't believe that you'll actually survive.
Right. You know? Right.
So, yeah. So that's one thing. And then all the theological stuff, all the theodicy of figuring out how can there be a God if a baby can get cancer? You know, I had to kind of work my way through that.
Well, can I ask what does work for you in that?
Yeah. So to me, it was, you know, how we sometimes, if we're lucky, we get those messages, however they come to us. Mm-hmm. And I got it was after she had cancer the first time, quite a while after she had recovered. I would take these long walks just thinking, and on one of those walks, I just got this really clear sort of feeling of, like God was talking to me, but you know, it's not that clear, right? But this really clear message of this is how the world works, that things like can happen, and I'm so sorry, and you need to know that when you grieved, I grieved.
Yeah.
And there was something in that felt, it didn't feel like my imagination, you know, it felt real and it felt solid. And that was something that, you know, even to now, right? Global pandemic, whatever, it still fits with that.
Right. Yeah. So can you say more about that, especially in regards to the pandemic and
I mean, I don't really, you know, I know that that idea is often distilled down into this sort of, what do they call it? Like the clockmaker idea, right? That God, you know, created the world and then, you know, was kind of hands off.
Yeah, the deism.
I don't know what the answer is. That doesn't feel entirely like it. Right. And that's probably something that I still struggle with, and I will probably be struggling with my entire life, is because sometimes there are definitely things that feel like there is a hand in all of this. And then there are other things that how could there possibly be a hand in all of this? I mean, I guess for me, like in terms of justice, you know, it was MLK kind of made it sound a little nicer, but it was a Unitarian, Theodore Parker, who talked about the arc of the universe bending toward justice.
Right.
And he was really clear about like that this is a long way off. He said, I can't see it by my eye, but I feel like the arc bends towards justice. And I tend toward process theology. And so that all works for me, this idea of that somehow there is a force working in us and through us, a seduction towards the good.
Yeah.
You know, and in terms of things like cancer, that God works with and through science, not in opposition to science.
Right. I think we share some similar views in that regard. Speaking of process theology, let's kind of go down that path a little bit. How did you get introduced to it? How did that become something that was relevant for you?
Yeah. So I once heard a description of process theology, or not really a description. It was someone said, you really can't explain it without a thesaurus and a slide rule. And so for a long time, I guess I'm just not smart enough. Like it didn't do anything for me. And then when I was in seminary, I read, it was a short essay by a Unitarian minister named Gary Kowalski about God as a verb. And I just, it hit me and I understood it. And so then, like, once I was exposed to sort of that overarching idea, I was able to go deeper into it. And so it, you know, and to me, it just kind of seems sort of logical, and it seems like a logical extension even you know, in terms of the Christian idea of being the hands and feet of God.
I'm just thinking about a lot of different things, because we could go down this path of just talking about process theology together, and I'm not sure that's what I want to do for this interview, but I want to get a sense of what it was like to grow up Unitarian in Texas, because it's not a dominant tradition in Texas. And as you mentioned earlier, it's so many people come to your congregation from other traditions, and finding someone who's grown up in that tradition is unusual in this area. So tell me a little bit about that.
So first of all, I have to kind of define that. So I was born in 1969, and especially in the 70s, really the 50s through the 70s, Unitarian Universalism was heavily agnostic, if not atheist. The human, the people who created the Humanist Manifesto,
right.
I think the majority of them were Unitarian. So I had that kind of going in my religious life. I lived in a very conservative area, and I had the experience, like if you talk to any UU who grew up in the South, we all have the same story, which is in kindergarten, having a child, a classmate ask us, if Jesus was our savior, and then being told that we were going to hell when we answered in the negative. And the sad thing is, you would like to think that that has changed. I can tell you from raising my kids, nope, they are still doing that in kindergarten. The good thing is, in my faith, we have learned better than we did when I was a kid. We've learned how to give our children help in being able to form answers. And I can remember my son when he, because the first principle of UUism is about the inherent worth and dignity of all people. And I can remember him coming home from kindergarten and talking about a particular classmate and saying, and I told him that I respected his inherent worth and dignity, but I just didn't believe like he did.
That's so wonderful. Yeah. That's great.
So, religiously, in terms of my peers, I really, I always felt like I didn't fit in.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, and I've talked to so many people who grew up UU at the same time I did that had the same experience. We were being raised by parents, by Unitarian parents, who said, our religion is one where you can believe whatever you want to believe. Thank goodness we don't say that anymore. But that was what they said then.
Mm-hmm.
But then when we started saying things like, well, I think I believe in God, many times our parents in our church were not supportive of that. So we kind of grew up feeling like we didn't fit in at church entirely, and we didn't fit in with our peers entirely. So that's a little bit, thankfully things have gotten better on both sides of that.
Yeah. Well, it strikes me, and hearing this part of your story, and of course the story with your daughter and her illness, that you bring a lot to being a pastor, that you understand the island that sometimes people feel like they might be on, and that has to be such a gift to your congregants to have a minister who has that kind of empathy to their situation. So
I think it can be. I will say the one thing that I was missing that I had to learn from other people's experience was I did not grow, I did grow up in a faith where it was, where you were asked, what do you believe? And there were no wrong answers. Parents might look at you a little strange when you started talking about your experiences of the divine, but no one was going to say that was a bad answer.
Right.
And I in my home congregation one time, I had a friend, it was actually a seminary professor who had come to guest speak, preach this one Sunday, and he'd grown up in a very conservative church. And then I had a member who had grown up, she said it was Church of Christ, but like they looked at the other Churches of Christ and thought that they were too liberal. And I'm talking Church of Christ, not United Church of Christ.
Yeah.
And I happened to overhear her ask him, how long did it take before he stopped waking up in the middle of the night and going, oh my God, what if I'm all wrong and I'm going to burn in hell and whatever. And this was a seminary professor, right? And he said, when that day happens, I'll let you know.
Oh.
And that I had no experience with that dynamic. And so that was definitely one that I had to learn from others. And so when, you know, if someone comes to me and says, you know, that they have made this switch, you know, Unitarian, you know, often what I'll hear is, oh, it's the religion I always knew that I was, but didn't know it existed. But right. like they'll have a they'll have a parent who is putting a lot of pressure on them because they've
right,
made this
right,
change.
Right.
I can't say that I have the understanding of having lived through that, but I have been able to see how hard it is
right.
to escape that.
Right. It is a difficult transition. It is a difficult journey. To let go of some of those condemning beliefs.
Right.
Because they get so embedded. Well, I'm glad you were there to do that. Okay, so I'm gonna change directions significantly because I see three guitars and a piano behind you.
And a banjo.
Banjo on the other guitar. So tell me about the musician, Joanna.
Okay, so the banjo has not been fully learned yet. That is okay. my hopeful one up there. So I love music, but I have to, you know, what I say is, you know, if someone says, do you play guitar? I'm like, well, I pretend to play guitar. When I was a college student in Texas, I'm pretty sure it's the law that you have to pick up a guitar. So I've played, you know, since I was in college, and written music. And when I was going through all the stuff with my daughter, that was a huge outlet, being able to put those things into music. My husband also has a musical background. And we got musical kids. I have a daughter who, she's the one who has really learned how to play the piano, and she's a singer. And then she's 21. And then I have another one who is now the band geek, who is playing mellophone and French horn, and wants a bass guitar for Christmas. So, it's just a part of our life.
And do you incorporate that into your ministry?
Very rarely. I am almost phobic about playing in, I mean, it's crazy. I can preach in front of thousands and it doesn't bother me at all, but playing guitar in front of people, yeah, you too. I like, my fingers freeze. And so I did a couple of years ago, because I had a sermon about kind of pushing yourself, you know, if you have received messages before, which I had, you know, you're not musical, that kind of thing, to try and push through those. Mm-hmm. And so I actually played and sang Fleetwood Mac's Landslide because of that, that line about, I built my life around you. And so the sermon was about what are the lies you've built your life around. And I had a lot of people come up to me and say, oh, that was so great, we hope you'll do it again. And I was like, never. I mean, I know it sounds terrible, right? I wasn't listening to my own sermon, but if I do that, it'll be something completely away from ministry, because I need to keep those two worlds separate.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I play the piano a little bit, and over the years at Church of the Savior, I was the backup pianist on several occasions, and my hands were never so clammy as the Sundays where I was filling in on the piano. And I can get up and talk in front of thousands of people, but playing the piano for people to sing along is a whole different story. So I get you. I'm right there with you.
So it's something that is more for me. So, and in ministry, right, it's actually kind of nice to have something that's just for you.
Yeah, I'll sit down here at home and play and just whatever I want and can make whatever mistakes I want. And who's it going to impact? No one, you know? So exactly. Yes, that was one of my, you know, that's a me thing. Yeah. So, well, I want to just think through all that we've talked about and simply ask you if there's anything else that you feel like would be good for people to know that we've either skimmed over or we skipped because we moved on to something else. What else needs to be shared here that I haven't specifically asked?
Yeah, so I guess, you know, one of the interesting things that you and I have both experienced is what does it mean to be a woman minister in Texas?
Right? Oh, yes. Have you gotten the letters with pastor in quotes?
Oh, I have not. I know you have. I have not. Yeah. I mean, maybe, I don't know. Maybe I have and I just, you know, blew it off. No, what I have had is I've you know, going to meetings where there's other clergy and the male ministers are, you know, Reverend and I'm Joanna.
Ah, yes.
Of course. Definitely having people walk into the church and asking, even though I'm like, they knock on my door where it says senior minister Joanna Von Dan Crawford, and I open the door and they say, they look at me and they go, can I speak to the minister? but I also have had people who, you know, especially women with daughters who come to the church and they're the first thing that attracts them is that it was a woman's name and they want to show their kids that.
Yeah.
Before the pandemic, I had a tradition of every Friday I would put on the clerical collar with a little rainbow pin. And it wasn't that I would do something so much. A lot of times I'd just be working on a sermon, but like I would go somewhere in public just so people could see that. And I can't even tell you how many times I've had someone, you know, especially Catholic women who grew up Catholic who really loved seeing a woman in the collar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It representation matters.
Right.
Well, speaking of the pandemic, how are things going during the pandemic for you personally and for your congregation?
So they're going really well. And I would say because of a whole lot of work, right? I talk about how our paths take us through some interesting things. When my first ministry internship was with a church that was exclusively online, and we started. It had been a church by mail kind of thing for, you know, decades, and they hired me as the intern and. We just kind of said, okay, we're going to do online worship. And we had no idea what we were doing. And so it was just a matter of learning it as we went. And so that was great.
So you've already done this before.
Right. I've talked honestly,
so many ministers is like, yeah, we're just making this up as we go.
Yeah. Like March 12th was when I sent an email to our board and said, we got to shut down. Here's why. And that Sunday, we did our last in-person one. And the following Sunday, we had an online service. In fact, I have to confess, I think I actually had a video from 8 years ago that I used for the first one just to buy me some time to get everything set up.
Interesting.
But so that has been, it was, I'm just so incredibly grateful that I can't imagine trying to do this and learn it on the fly. And people have been great. Like we just had our annual stewardship. You know, we have families that have lost jobs and other people stepped forward and we actually wound up, higher in pledges than a year ago. But it's really hard. Our church gets about a third of its income from rentals. We have a couple of long-term renters that are still with us, but for the most part, that ended.
Yeah.
Our members, it's hard, but our members are great. They set up an online trading post, a spreadsheet in those early days, so that if you couldn't find toilet paper somewhere and someone else had more toilet paper, they would bring it over to
you. Oh, that's great.
So a lot of the stuff like that has been strengthening, and the fact that our members keep saying, we're so grateful you're doing this. And I have these older members who had never Zoomed before,
right,
who kind of considered the internet to be like the stuff of the devil, not that Unitarian Universalists believe in the devil, but
right,
like they got on and they learned how to do it. So
yeah,
we're doing okay.
Yeah. Are you finding any fatigue as the months drag on, 7 months in now?
In them or in me?
Both. With, you know, doing things online and just saying, you know, I just would rather see people in person, and I'll wait till that can happen. Or
we lost surprisingly few. I think we lost like we only had one family that said, and they were fairly new, and they said, we don't already have the relationships. But I can tell that it is affecting us. I can tell it in our meetings. Mm-hmm. And the biggest thing has been with the kids. It is so hard to do religious education right now because they are online 5 days a week, hours at a time.
Yes.
And so when we say, hey, come on Sunday and get on Zoom, they're like, please
no.
Don't stay. So we're trying to figure out other ways to do that.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of what I was getting at. Are you finding a Zoom fatigue of sorts, and between kids at school and parents working, and like how many meetings can you go to? And
So interestingly, for the social stuff, it seems to still be working. Like we have a weekly sack lunch with the minister that I do online. We have a senior coffee. And people are showing up to that and expressing appreciation for it. I don't know why that works better and the meetings are harder. And maybe part of it is simply that people are having to do meetings with their actual jobs. And so it's harder to be really clear, this is my church life, not my business
life. Right. Wow. Before we started recording, you had mentioned that you were supposed to go on a sabbatical April 1st. How's that working out for you?
So I can clearly, you know how there's moments in time where you can look back and it's like a movie, you can remember it so clearly. So I was doing all the stuff that you do to prepare, you know, for sabbatical, writing the things of why we do this. And I had our intern minister was going to transition and be our sabbatical minister. So I was getting all that set up. And I can remember, like at the start of March, sitting at our you know, one of our meeting tables with other church leaders, and saying, yeah, we're hearing about this thing. And I'm setting up, you know, I'm setting up a file with some videos in case we need to, you know, not do church for a couple of weeks.
And
I remember saying, okay, but like, you know, if this is the zombie apocalypse, like Wuhan, I just won't go on sabbatical. And all of us laughing. Well, I didn't go on sabbatical. Our sabbatical minister became assistant minister, which was wonderful to help us kind of get started before she left and started doing CPE. And so we just had a budget meeting because we need to be putting our budget together for 2021. And so the president said, okay, so what about sabbatical? And I said, because now it's just me, I'm the only minister. I said, okay, I can't go on sabbatical, while this is going on. Once we're able to be back together again, I'm going to need to be there, you know, for the first few months. I said, let's try and put some money back and maybe in 2022, because I'm really going to need a sabbatical.
You're going to need a sabbatical in 2022. Definitely. Oh, I'm sorry you didn't get to take it. And I will, I'm hopeful that 2022, you will be able to do that. Oh my goodness. Well, Joanna, thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it. Really appreciate hearing stories from your life and your congregation. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you for asking me.
All right. Let me...